Welcome to Hablamos, conversations on teaching, learning, and via multilingualism, the podcast of the ICME-EE project at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. As mentioned in the name, the main goal of this podcast is to embrace multilingualism. So we are going to have conversation around this topic in the classroom and how teachers can support by a multilingual development. I'm Araceli Lobato and I will be your host. So I hope you enjoy today's conversation. So welcome to our podcast. Today in our episode, we have Dr. How do you pronounce your surname?
Well, I'm Edmund Hammann.
Edmund Hammann.
I go as Ted Hammann, and that's my mother's fault.
Your mother's fault?
My mother's fault. She said I could be named Edmund after my grandfather if she could call me Ted. So here we are. The important part of the last name is Hammann.
Hammann.
Yes.
Something like that. It sounds good.
Yeah. Well, and people have called me all kinds of things. I'm used to that.
So welcome to our podcast. We always start our podcast talking about our the guest's private life a little bit, like what are you doing here? What kind of your position in the university? So that way our listener can know you a little bit more.
Okay. So I am in my 13th year at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. I am a full professor in the Department of Teaching, Learning, and Teacher Education. I came to Lincoln, Nebraska after previously working for a regional education laboratory in Providence, Rhode Island, that was affiliated with Brown University. Mm-hmm. But if I describe the span of my career relatively briefly, but, you know, sir, why should anybody pay any attention to my ideas about language and about teaching children from different language backgrounds? My first job after college in the early 1990s was to coordinate what was called a bilingual family literacy program. And that, at that time, this was in Kansas City, Kansas, at that time, the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986 and the Seasonal and Agricultural Worker Act of 1988 mm-hmm. meant that a significant Spanish-speaking population, primarily from Mexico, was in the process of regularizing status, meaning coming out of the shadows to get permanent residency and ultimately start a pathway to citizenship. And that also gave a right and a safety to legalizing family members to sort of, and so young men who had families back in Mexico, for example, but had come north to work could petition to have spouses and children join them. So it meant that I was teaching language and literacy to adults at a time when the Mexican newcomer population in the Midwest was growing. And the task I had, the program was created by the National Council of La Raza, which is a Latino-oriented civil rights organization. The idea was to, one, test a curriculum, but two, to affirm both first and second language skills. And so I had many students who came, and, you know, students who were also parents, and they were interested in developing English skills. You know, I'm in America now, I want to understand English better. And the pedagogical design we were following, the program design, knew and tried to attend to the fact that people make sense of a second language using their already developed language skills. And so one of the things that I had to do as an instructor was help students access their existing language knowledge to troubleshoot a little bit their acquisition of English. And there are, in this case, there are some remarkable ways that English and Spanish overlap, and then there's some important ways that they differ. And so there is some safety, for example, in borrowing words that have Latin roots in English and in Spanish, so words of science. So, for example, biología in Spanish is not very hard to turn into biology. Yeah. And once you realize, if biología is biology, maybe geología is geology. You know, and maybe photosynthesis is photosynthesis. You know, I mean, complicated words, perhaps, content area knowledge for science, but actually quite closely mapping. And if you're trying to teach a new language and you're trying to have somebody in a position to describe why the leaves are changing color, for example, they may already bring a fair amount of the language knowledge necessary to do the description as long as they have a few more tricks. So anyway.
So you didn't teach Spanish itself, but you give them like tools and methodology to help them to build the new language, that is in this case English, with the things that they knew in Spanish. So did you use any multilingual pedagogy?
Oh, yes. No, absolutely. And so, I mean, one of the paradoxes, I was a second language Spanish speaker. The comfort with Spanish and the vocabulary in Spanish, the familiarity with Spanish on my students was ahead of mine. I had, at that stage in my life, I had lived and worked in Latin America. I'd lived in Panama and Ecuador and in Mexico. Mexico several times, and I'd studied Spanish as a second language in U.S. schools.
So we can do this in Spanish if you want.
Sí, podemos continuar en español si te puedo.
Sin problema.
Va a estar otro asunto, pero puedo continuar en español si quieres. Anyway, I can continue this in Spanish if you want.
Yeah.
But no, so my task with the students from Mexico, many of whom, you know, at that time, and Mexico has made tremendous leaps in the last 30 years in terms of extending education to more and more of its population. But, yeah, you know, 28 years ago when I'm talking about, there were lots of adults at that time who had only primaria, so only through sixth grade education. People from rural backgrounds sometimes had even less than that, sort of three or four years of school. So they were, to the extent they knew any language, they knew Spanish. They were fluent in Spanish. Sometimes there was an indigenous language, too, like Purépecha or Zapoteca. That's a whole interesting, different issue. But in terms of literacy skills, in terms of, you know, reading and writing and some of the uses of language, I faced the task with at least some of them. If a goal was to learn how to read and write and speak and listen in English, the task of reading and writing was not necessarily a skill. Everybody was familiar with what the intent was, but it was not necessarily a skill that had been fairly very far advanced. And so one of the things we did a lot of was, you know, reading, writing, and talking in Spanish, as well as reading, writing, and talking in English. Partly, and there were several reasons for that. One of the points, I found that these adults were very self-conscious of the limitations in their English facility at that time. And so I was actually able to create a partnership with a number of high school students who wanted to do sort of service learning projects. And in this case, the high school students were first language English speakers. They had had a chance, all of the ones I'm remembering, had a chance to spend summers working in Latin America with various sort of Peace Corps-like public health programs, but for high school students. And they were interested in developing and maintaining their Spanish. And then my primary students, the arriving parents, were interested in developing their skills in English. So I was able to set up these dyads where the Mexican newcomer to Kansas City was teaching Spanish to the, you know, born in Kansas City American who had spent part of a summer in the Dominican Republic and, you know, had a whole new world opened up to them. And so what was nice is that the language skills of both parties in these tutoring environments were sometimes sources of expertise. I can teach you this. And sometimes they were sources of inquiry. How do you say that? And so, and it was really these conversations where neither was sufficiently proficient in the target language of the other that the conversation could stay monolingual. And so there would be this sort of a fair amount of translanguaging, although we didn't use that turn of phrase then. But there's a fair amount of translanguaging and just sort of problem solving using language, using gesture, using writing, and reading, you know, and so it was very much a bilingual environment. But I warned you that this might last longer than 10 minutes. I realize I'm still introducing myself, and here we are at like the 8-minute mark.
No worries.
But
no
anyway, worries. So it was my first foray in the world of professional education was quite literally as a language teacher. And a language teacher to a very heterogeneous enrollment. You know, what was shared by all my students is, A, they were willing to come on a class on Tuesday morning and Thursday morning or Tuesday night and Thursday night. But they were also, which was free, they were sort of attending voluntarily. And they were interested in better understanding English. They were all first language Spanish speakers. But I had people who had had a little bit of college, and I had people who had 2 years of school ever. And, you know, they were similar in that mm-hmm. they were parents, they were adults, and they wanted to learn English. But they were very, very dissimilar in terms of developed skills, with formal skills mm-hmm. With the language. And so I had to also concurrently learn how to differentiate my instruction for learners that were at different levels. And that was one of the reasons that I recruited these high school volunteers, because it meant that I could, you know, people at very different levels could have one-on-one or one-on-two attention.
Wow, that's great. So do you recommend these kind of things for newcomers, for instance, or for teachers that are teaching, for instance, in a high school, to try to get these kind of volunteers or people who they know, or they may know some language and they want to improve it? So just try to connect it with the community or with another association or something like that?
Certainly. I mean, I would argue that any teacher facing their teaching task needs to ask themselves, what are the resources that I as teacher bring to the table, and what are resources that I can leverage that contribute to sort of the forward progress of everyone who is part of your charge. Teaching in a public library like I was, for a community organization, for adults who had full-time and sometimes longer jobs, and, you know, I needed to be more of an entertainer perhaps than some teachers do, because if it didn't feel like it was worth students' time, they literally could disappear. And, you know, if you teach a fourth grader, it's a different scenario. They're supposed to be there. So I think I had to be, I don't want to say more creative, because there's, you know, classroom teachers can be quite creative, but I had to create more, in that there was much less of an infrastructure already in place. But there's a couple points that I wanted to make sure that I squeezed in.
Yeah, for sure.
One is just sort of a fascination with the, you know, what is language? And I mean, we're using it all the time. We're using it right now. But what is the it that we're using? And one of the better definitions I've ever encountered is, language is an index of a society's thought.
Index of the society thought.
So basically, it's the symbology. I don't know. It's the
symbology.
There we go. It's the codes that we use to sort of to label various mm-hmm. ideas. So I can say a word to you like father, and you know, you hear it and you, haha, a parent who is male, you know, and there's,
you picture it.
And you may have other implications of the word father, and you may know different fathers than I knew, and you may be, oh wait, father, you mean like a priest? You know, I mean, there may be other ramifications that you sort of, you hear. But one of the things that's amazing is my neurology, my brain, my nerve system is not connected to yours. And we've created this mechanism that, you know, sort of across space, literally the air in this room, I can share a concept, you hear the concept, you maybe not exactly understand what I'm intending, but you come sufficiently close that our communication is successful, right? And languages index all kinds of ideas, and one of the fascinating things is, when an idea doesn't exist in a language, sometimes a language grows by borrowing. So I'm a child of the 1980s. Well, I was born in the 60s. But at any rate, I remember when the Berlin Wall was coming down, and before mm-hmm. that, when under Gorbachev, the Soviet Union was opening up. And so suddenly words like glasnost and perestroika, glasnost meant opening and perestroika meant restructuring mm-hmm. in Russian, and they became English language words because it was part of the news of the day, and there were no sufficiently specific words in English to fully capture what we were trying to describe. Roughly the same time, the word tortilla chip mm-hmm. suddenly became the rage. So tortilla became an English language word, right? Kamikaze in World War II became an English language word, right? And so all of these express concepts that...
I deal with that every day.
So all of this, you know, and then you can ask yourself the question, and particularly if you know a language, say you know Spanish, and you know, okay, so is frijoles an English word or a Spanish word? Because I hear it in the U.S., but am I hearing it when people are saying it in Spanish, just because a lot of people know what beans are? Or you know, is this...
But in the case of frijoles, you have like a literary translation.
Yeah.
But there are other words that you cannot find the proper translation, so you have to figure it out how to explain it.
And actually, going to what do teachers need to know about language, One of the things, I mean, perhaps the most important message of this entire podcast, and I suspect other guests would say something similar, mm-hmm. language is a resource. Yeah. And if, you know, any student who comes to us who has a language background of any type has a resource, and we may know how to tap it and we may not, but if we don't, the problem isn't in the student, the problem is in our skill set to access what the student knows. So, for example, people use what they know, constructivist learners would say, people use what they know to make sense of what they don't know. Sometimes language can index an idea in a certain language that isn't as easy to say in another language. There's this sort of old joke that a number of Inuit languages have all kinds of words for different kinds of snow because their language is from the Arctic, and you know, the snow that you can use to pack and make a igloo is different than the snow that you need to worry about because cold weather is coming, is different than the snow that makes good snowballs, is, you know, whatever, right? There's all of these different words for snow. Snow is an important enough word in English that we use the word snow pretty routinely. I would propose to you there are languages in the, you know, tropics of Africa or South America. Snow, what's that? You know, I don't. Because why do I need the concept, right? Yeah. So you can literally have a place where there's no word at all. But I want to come back because you were hinting at how sometimes it's easier to say something in one language than another. And you would be quite familiar with the distinction between saber and conocer in Spanish. If you went to Google Translate, the translation in both cases would be to know. And yet they're not interchangeable words. So saber, which has an irregular first-person singular form, se, you know, so yo sé, I mean, which literally means I know, mm-hmm. typically means I know a fact. Mm-hmm. Yo sé la respuesta, I know the answer. Right, but I can't really say yo sé mi esposa. I know my wife.
No.
I mean, I may saber might fit in the sense that I know that I have one. But typically, I would use know in English to mean I am familiar with. This is a person mm-hmm. who is part of my sort of social orbit, and so I would use the other know verb, conocer. Yo conozco a mi esposa. Right.
You must know your
yeah.
Wife.
No, right. Otherwise, all kinds of weird things are going on. Yes. But anyway, so. In Spanish, you can make a distinction between types of knowing. And once in English, I was an evaluator in the mid-1990s of a program targeting African American, summer education program targeting African American youth. The only part of this that matters for this conversation is that part of the evaluation plan for this program, and I was one of the evaluators, was to have what was called a connoisseurial visit. And a connoisseurial visit, you don't run into the word connoisseurial mm-hmm. very often in yeah. English. If you look it up, it does exist.
Okay, we'll check it in.
But the word conocer in Spanish, mm-hmm. and both come from the same Latin root, to be familiar with. The premise of a connoisseurial visit, it was a very fancy way or strange way of saying one-day observation protocol. You will go watch, see, become familiar with this program. So one of the things that was useful for me when I was trying to make sense of, okay, I'm the evaluator, they want me to do a connoisseurial evaluation, what's that?
What's that?
Part of the answer was I could use my repository, my understanding of the language of Spanish. This is one of those know, become familiar with, you know, and so in this case, I was able to use knowledge from a different language as a resource to make sense of a concept in my first language that nonetheless was a concept rare enough, unusual enough, that it wasn't something that in day-to-day conversation or day-to-day learning I had picked up to that point.
So saying that, my question will be, what kind of advice would you give to a teacher that have, for instance, a heritage student or someone that they might know another language? So what kind of advice could you give to this teacher?
Well, there's a couple challenges that come up, particularly when we talk about heritage language learners.
Yeah, that's very
learners.
Big, but...
But it's an important one. So relatively common in the United States, and particularly with Spanish, obviously mm-hmm. the second most important language in the United States is Spanish in mm-hmm. terms of number of speakers. And it's actually probably the second most common language of monolingual speakers. So there are a number of children who are coming from households where, you know, mom and dad may not know very much English, or certainly grandma doesn't know very much. Not far from here, I had the fortune of meeting a young woman in Crete, Nebraska, several years ago, whose family came from Oaxaca. Mm-hmm. Her grandmother was a monolingual, and I have to remember the indigenous language. It was not Zapotec. It was a more obscure language. Chinuntec. She was a Chinunteca speaker, mm-hmm. Which is an indigenous language, one of the indigenous languages of Oaxaca, Mexico. This student, she was a student at Crete High School, this student's mother was bilingual, knew Chinunteca and Spanish, but didn't really know English. And this young woman was bilingual, knew Spanish and school English. And the conversations with her grandmother were always sort of playing with, well, grandma knows a little bit of Spanish. She knows a little bit of English because she's living with us. The young woman knew a little bit of Chinunteca. I mean, these sort of surreal three-language interactions. But at any rate, for purposes of her Spanish teacher at Crete High School, here was somebody who already knew Spanish. Mm-hmm. But as somebody who'd grown up in Crete, Nebraska, she had very little direct experience studying Spanish as an academic language. And so one of the really interesting and hazardous things that language teachers can encounter is there are formal and academic forms of a language. And then there's often, sometimes they get dismissed as dialects, but there are often additional forms of a language that are less recognized at school. And so there's something very strange and unsettling and often problematic when a Spanish teacher tells a first language Spanish speaker, you're wrong. What do you mean I'm wrong? Wow. This is what my parents say. This is what my grandma says. This is, So one of the dilemmas a teacher in that scenario needs to figure out is it possible I know a version of Spanish, in this case, different than the variety of Spanish the student knows? And so backtracking to my experience several years ago back in Kansas City, my first teaching job, when I was teaching Spanish literacy to first language Spanish speakers, mm-hmm. one of the dilemmas I needed to negotiate was I was sort of teaching literacy skills to people who knew a language better than I did and used it in more ways for more purposes in their daily life than I used Spanish. And so I was concurrently building but always needing to be very cautious of not coming across imperiously, oh, my Spanish is better than yours. It wasn't. On occasion, my Spanish was more likely to be recognized at school. Look, he can use the past subjunctive, or whatever, right? But at any rate, so the advice, a piece of advice to teachers here is to recognize, one, the intertwining of language and identity, two, the idea that the languages that children bring to school may not be the form that historically has been celebrated. Mm-hmm. This isn't the official Spanish. Well, telling somebody their version of Spanish is wrong is really, 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 really hazardous. Pointing out that Iberian Spanish is different from Southern Cone Spanish, Argentina and Chile, is different from Mexican Spanish, that there are a bunch of Mexican Spanishes, is different from the Spanish you'd hear in East Los Angeles or in along the Rio Grande border. Or, there's been Spanish spoken in Omaha, Nebraska since the 19-teens, going back to the history of the packing plants there. The Spanishes that are extant all over the place are different. But the advice to teacher is to recognize that a student has a repertoire, and there's a
that
big...
was my whole point.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
I'm kidding.
No, so there's that. But
Tell
I
them to, yeah.
Well, and but let me throw two other analogies here. One is Spanish and English. They're not from English has a lot of words from German. So in German, we I think could say good night, gute Nacht. And you actually, if you looked at the spelling in English, you'd be like, oh. Gut and good, huh? Knocked, night. Oh, okay. This is definitely borrowed from German. And the Spanish equivalent of that, buenas noches, there's really very little overlap in terms of, the concept is the same, but the language origins are distinct from each other. At any rate, Spanish and English still have a fair amount of overlap, and so you can cheat a little bit. This would be true of French and English. This would be true of Portuguese and English. The Latin languages and the Germanic languages have some overlap with English because most of English comes either from German or from Latin. And there's a handful of words like kamikaze that have other origins. But mostly it's from German and Latin. But there are languages that are more different. And think of a language like Russian. Different alphabet. But intriguingly, and I can't tell you, I just remember this from your presentation, so I can't tell you what the Russian word for kindergarten is, but I do know that the Russian word for kindergarten, and kindergarten is actually a word that we borrow directly from German. Mm-hmm. Kinder is children, garten literally is garden.
Garden.
And the Russian word for kindergarten is the Russian word for children plus the Russian word for garden. So the language concepts match, even though the forms, you know, look entirely different. And so one of the other things that's interesting to me about language is ideas sort of go around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I would propose kindergarten is an idea that went around the world at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. Oh, as we formally educate children, let's give them an introduction to school that is mostly an organized time of play. And they can explore and they can gain a sense of self. That was the premise of kindergarten. And lots of society said, oh, we should do that with our children too. And so as they borrowed the idea, they borrowed the, if not the word directly like we did in English in America, they borrowed the concept like they did in Russia. And so the word child garden, referencing a year of schooling. It's kind of interesting. So
yeah.
So one other point I want to make related to language as a resource. We tend in most countries, but certainly in the U.S., to appraise knowledge in one language and let that stand in as language skill.
Mm-hmm.
So let me trace, if I might, a scenario where you have two students in a class. One is a monolingual English speaker, and one emigrated from Poland 8 years ago. Parents are hardworking. Parents' ability to learn much English has been restricted by workplace busyness. So at home, this second child speaks Polish to parents.
Mm-hmm.
At school, speaks English. And this child is no longer identified as an English language learner because their English is sufficiently proficient that the school system has decided you're not an English language learner.
Mm-hmm.
But we give a test in America to both of these kids. And the monolingual English speaker on this test gets an 80. And the child originally from Poland takes the test, gets a 70. And then we decide, let's give a second test to both of these kids. We'll make the second test in Polish. And the kid who came from Poland gets a 70 again. And the kid who's a monolingual English speaker doesn't even know what he's looking at and gets a 0, right? So if we think which kid is linguistically more skilled, if we look only at the English output, 80 to 70, it's the first child, it's the monolingual kid. If we did only Polish, it's the Polish child, Polish. Only Polish, right? But if we thought holistically about developed language competence, it's a little bit simplistic to say 80 plus 0 versus 70 plus 70. But if we did, it would be 140 to 80. And the child who we too often in America say is behind,
mm-hmm.
They're behind the monolingual kid, actually has a more sophisticated language repertoire. And the limitation or the possible limitation at our end is that we don't have a mechanism to capture that, to use that, to appraise that. It doesn't mean it isn't there. It just means we don't know how to use it. The problem isn't located in the child. It's located in our instructional design.
Wow. I think that that was awesome, and I really appreciated your time and your advice. So if you want to be in contact to Dr. Say again your surname?
Dr. Hammond.
Hammond. You know, the glottal stop is very difficult for me, so... thank you so much for being here. And if you wanted to be in contact with him, you can just check the podcast notes and letting him know if you have some questions for him.
Okay, so that will have my email address.
Yeah.
Okay, sure.
So thank you so much for being here. And
my pleasure. Thank you. Muy agradecido.